Welcome back to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. I'm Daniel Emery Price, and I am with Chad Bird and Brandon Hansen. How are you guys doing this morning?
Hey, we're good.
I'm doing good. Ready to go.
Doing great, yeah.
Okay. You guys sound real excited. You know what the source of all this excitement is? That we're going to get into Joseph today, and we're all just bummed out about how perfect Joseph is, and we're just feeling real crappy about ourselves. So
I just don't feel like I can, you know, measure up to Joseph. He is Jacob, you know. It's going to be hard to say goodbye to Jacob, because Jacob is somebody I can identify with on so many levels. And then we come across Joseph, and he's just like too clean. So
Joseph is checking all the boxes.
He's checking all the boxes. Yeah. So, this is going to be an interesting exercise. We'll have to kind of get into his story and see where we find our place in it.
Okay. All right. So here we go. We are on mission. Figure out if Joseph was or was not a sinner.
Yeah, that's right. That is the first priority. We got to figure that out. Go from there.
Okay, let's do it.
All right. So we are kind of skipping a chapter here. I hope that's fine with everyone. I think if you look at it, you'll understand why. We finished up with chapter 35 in Genesis last time. Chapter 36 is a 43 verse genealogy of our friend Esau. And I didn't think that there would be too many objections to skipping over that. So that's what we're going to do.
Okay.
Unless, Dan, you want to talk about the etymology of some of these names and the geographical importance of, I mean, there is one verse here which says that Anna found the hot springs in the wilderness when he was pasturing the donkeys of his father. We wanted to maybe exegete that.
There's a town about 3 hours south of where I live called Hot Springs. I am wondering if there's any correlation there.
Obviously there is. Yeah. You have a biblical basis now for Hot Springs, Arkansas.
There it is.
Not many people realize that. So put that in your Bible trivia box in your head next time it comes up. Hot Springs was where Anna found the donkeys. Here we go.
That's it. All right.
All right, and that is about the only extremely interesting verse in chapter 36. So we're going to move right on to chapter 37. So we are beginning a really huge section in Genesis. This is by far the lengthiest, most detailed story that we have in the book of Genesis. Several chapters about Abraham, not many about Isaac, several chapters about Jacob. But now you get to the story of Joseph, and it starts in 37, and it doesn't finish until the end of the book, chapter 50. And there's a couple of chapters in there which aren't focused primarily upon him, such as chapter 38, which is about Judah, and chapter 49, which is where Jacob blesses his 12 sons. But otherwise, the story mainly revolves around him, and that's why many people have talked about this as sort of a short novel, a novella. Because it has the character develop, it has the kind of the psychological manipulation of readers, like techniques of character development, all that kind of stuff, suspense that novels have. And also, this is kind of interesting too. This sets it apart from the other narratives because it's almost at times secular in tone. Because Joseph doesn't build any altars, he's not associated with any worship centers. Quite a bit of the story goes by and there's no mention of God whatsoever. God doesn't speak. God doesn't explicitly act. It's like he's in the background. And he's the one who's guiding the events that take place here. And that really is one of the major themes that you see here in the story is I guess what you might call the present absence of God. That is, he seems absent from the life of Joseph, and yet he's present the whole way through. And it's only really at the end of the story that we see how God was at work, hidden within the narrative, hidden within the life and the sufferings, the deprivations, the backstabbings, everything that's going on to bring his people to the place where he wants them to be. So, that, I mean, that's one of the major themes that we're going to see here, which is what we often call the theology of the cross, where God hides himself under the opposite. We see that exemplified time and time again in the life of Joseph. In fact, Luther several times refers to the life of Joseph as a as Joseph's suffering, crucifixion, and resurrection. So he sees throughout the life of Joseph really a pattern that is foreshadowing what's going to happen to Christ. So he sees him as a type or foreshadowing of the Messiah. So lots of good stuff we have to go over here, but we'll get started at the beginning. We know a little bit about Joseph already. We know that he was one of Jacob's many sons, of his four wives, and he was the favorite son, as we're going to hear in just a minute, because he was the first son of his most beloved wife, Rachel, who at this point has already died. So that's kind of the background. That's really all we know about Joseph up to this point, is that he is the son of Rachel, who then later had Benjamin and died in childbirth. So let's pick it up. We're here in chapter 37. So here's how it starts. We got Jacob living in the land where his father had sojourned. So he's in the land of Canaan. And then it jumps immediately to a description of Joseph. So here's what we know about him from the opening verses. First of all, and this is important to bear in mind, he's a teenager. He's 17 years old. In fact, this just dawned on me. Joseph is the same age as my daughter. She's a senior in high school. So when you're thinking of Joseph, just kind of think of a junior or senior in high school. And I think that kind of gives you a little bit of a clue as to what kind of a person we're dealing with here. So, I mean, he's not like 35, 40 years old. He's not 10. He's fully into his teenage years. So he's 17. It says he's pastoring the flock with his brothers while he was young. It goes on to talk about who they are. And one little note here, it calls Bilhah and Zilpah the wives of Jacob. Now, one thing to bear in mind here is that, first of all, Rachel's dead, and Leah might be dead. As seems to be consistent with her story, she's basically ignored. We're not even told when she died. Her death is never mentioned, but there's a possibility that she's already dead at this point. So the maidservants are the only two mothers of Jacob's children who are living, and so they seem maybe now to be elevated to full wife status. They're called the wives here. They're not called the concubines or maidservants or anything like that. So that kind of sets the stage. We got a teenager, and he's pasturing the flock with his brothers. And then the first note of negativity is given to us at the end of verse 2. Joseph brought back a bad report about his brothers to their father. Now, that's all we're told, a bad report. In the Hebrew, it's devar ra, which means just a bad word. So
Joseph is a snitch.
Yeah. Jacob never said, "Hey, if your brothers do something wrong, I want you to let me know what they did." All it says is he brought back a bad report about his brothers. And why would he do that?
Must be like an Old Testament thing that didn't happen today.
No, I've heard of it happening, but I just haven't personally experienced it myself.
It's so, probably. I'm guessing it went down like this. It's fallen on me to tell you this.
I feel it incumbent upon me that God has laid this on my heart to bring back a bad report about my brothers.
I want you. This hurts me more than it hurts them. It pains me to say this, Father, but
yeah, it pains me to say this, but this is what your sons, my brothers, are doing.
And obviously, I am not, or I wouldn't be telling you. Right. So do what you want with that.
So right away, we're told a little bit about Joseph you know, you kind of got to get into the mind of these characters, because as the scriptures usually do, they don't tell us as much as we want to know. What was this bad report? And how did Jacob react? And how did his, you know, what did his brothers think? And so on and so forth. Well, we're not told. All we're told is that a 17-year-old who was the favorite of his father brought back a bad report about his brothers.
And it's interesting. Like, it doesn't tell you what it is, but it does tell you that he did it, which tells you that it does matter, because it doesn't. The Bible doesn't give you a lot of details of stories, so the details it does give you matter somewhat. So because of how Joseph's relationship with his brothers is going to play out, this is setting up that relationship. It is a pawn on the board that says, well, okay, so this is something that happened or was happening.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Any detail is significant, especially in a narrative like this. So this does already move us toward a greater understanding of his relationship with his brothers. And up to this point, at least that I can remember anyway, there's no situation that has happened so far where there's at least friction between the brothers that we're told about. No doubt there was, but we're just not told about it. So this is the beginning. There was between Jacob and his sons. We learned that with the whole rape of Dinah, right? But the first recorded incident is here, and it's just going to get worse and worse and worse.
I guess my only question is, did he go and approach his brothers before he brings this bad report to his father, or did they just kind of get,
snitched on,
sidelined, or just like T-boned by this thing? As they're like, what? Like, you just went and told dad about that? Like,
yeah.
Okay. As a guy with brothers,
best interest in mind.
As a guy with brothers, like there is like a certain like bro code.
Oh yeah.
You don't go tell dad stuff. Like, that's you can't do that.
Unless you want to get beat up.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, that's not what you do. And to answer your question, Brandon, of course he went to his brothers. That's a given. That's what we always do. We go to our brothers first. And then they just told him to go fly a kite, so then he went to their father. I mean, of course he did.
He probably talked to him 2 or 3 times, in fact, before he went and talked to his dad.
I'm sure.
As all pious believers
yes.
do.
Yes.
Yeah, right. So that's the first thing that happened. And that is we have three different causes of animosity between these brothers. And this is the first of them, the bad report. Now, verse 3. It just gets worse. We're like, you know, in this, we're just going down, down, down here in this spiral, because we're told, now Israel loved Joseph more than all his sons because he was the son of his old age. So, I mean, that's bad enough. But then the verse concludes, and he made him a coat of many colors, or as my translation has it, a very colored tunic. We're not exactly sure what it was, but anyway. He made him this special, special coat. Now, how do you think that would have played with his brothers?
The snitch gets a gift? Yeah, that doesn't go over well.
Yeah, so dad's going to award our kid brother for tattling on us. This is just getting better by the moment. So he's got this extraordinary love for Joseph, and to really kind of throw it in the face of the other sons. He plasters all over Joseph this coat, which just screams, "This is my favorite." Even though he's the youngest, or almost the youngest, he becomes the one who is shown the favoritism. I mean, I would think that in most households it would be either the firstborn or at least one of the older brothers who is the one who is in charge, the one who's taking care of the other brothers, so on and so forth. But no, here it's the one who's almost the youngest of all who's given this special privilege. So the jealousy that happened between the sisters is now been transferred to their sons. Their sons are going to be the ones who kind of bear this maternal jealousy on into their relationship with their own brothers and with their father as well. About the coat of many colors or the very colored tunic, it is mentioned one other time in scripture. It's in 2 Samuel 13, I believe. And it's there, it's a description of these special kind of robes that the virgin daughters of royalty wore. So, you know, maybe this was like Joseph was wearing sort of a regal tunic kind of deal. Whatever it was, the clothing was this, you know, neon sign that said, I am the pet. I'm the one that the father loves the most and not you. So here's what happened. His brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers. And so how did they react? Well, they hated him and could not speak to him on friendly terms. That's a pretty strong language. You know, we don't move here from anger to jealousy to resentment, finally then reaching hatred. No, it says they saw that their father loved him more than all his other brothers. And so they hated him. And not only did they hate him, but, you know, sometimes we can't get along with people. We might even hate them, or at least we can't really stand to be around them, but we have to be. And so what do? Well, we fake it. You know, we might pretend like, yeah, we can get along with you, at least have, you know, some sort of workable arrangement when we're around each other. We're not biting each other's heads off. But no, they can't even speak to him. They can't even hide their contempt for Joseph. That's how serious it is.
But yeah, so, well, it's interesting that this isn't like a perceived favoritism. So the scriptures aren't saying like, and so the brothers are like, God, you know, gosh dang it, like we think that dad likes Joseph more.
It seems that way.
Seems that way. Like, yeah, like that's. So it's not like some kind of thing where no, like that is the way it is.
Yeah, it's obvious.
Like,
yeah.
The scriptures are not denying. In fact, they're explicitly stating that like Jacob is like a horrific parent, and then not only does he love one of his kids more than one of his other kids, which is kind of a no-no in parenting.
Right. Yeah, that's parenting 101.
Yeah. You know, I mean, maybe when you were growing up, like your parents would tell you, like, I love all you guys the same. Like, I love all my kids equally. Right. That's not the case with Jacob. No, he loves one of them more and is making it real obvious.
Yeah, you would think that the king of deception himself, Jacob, would be a little bit better about keeping this kind of, you know, at least in his own heart instead of making it explicit that way. Being a little bit deceptive, but no, it's all out there. He has made it abundantly clear by the special robe that he gives to Joseph.
I thought it was interesting that I just noticed this, that it says Israel loved Joseph more than any of his other sons because he was the son of his old age. Now I've got a little bit of experience with this. I know a lot of families. And so in case anybody doesn't realize this, when you've got like 8, 10, 12 kids in your family, you put your life blood into them, you make all of your mistakes, you live by the skin of your teeth, working whatever jobs that you can to support this massive family that you have, and then you have that one last or couple kids in your older years where you've kind of established yourself, you can kind of sit back and enjoy a kid. It's almost like they're your grandkid even. Mm-hmm. And you can just dole out, you know, love and attention and affection on them. You can sit back and relax and enjoy the kid for once rather than chasing them around, running around crazy, you know, disciplining them, probably over disciplining them, being too rigid. And now this one comes along and you're just like, I'm tired of doing that. And look at all the rest of them and how they turned out. It doesn't matter what I do. I'm just going to have fun with it. We're going to be buddies.
Well, there's.
I imagine that's kind of a little bit what Israel does with Joseph here.
Yeah, yeah. Me, I just had this conversation with my family was all together, and the three older kids were talking about how much easier the three younger kids had it.
Yeah,
and like, exactly. and it was not hypothetically. It was like, no. Like you had it. definitively easier than us three.
Oh yeah. Now, I'm the oldest. I'm the oldest of eight, and I can see this extremely clearly. The three youngest. I mean, and I don't feel any. I'm happy that, like, good. Like, mom and dad kind of eased up a little bit. But at the same time, I always got to kind of rub it in their face, like, yeah. I mean, it's like the stories that you hear grandpa telling, like, all right, when I was your age, we walked uphill in blizzards to school both ways. You know, like, so.
By the way, my younger siblings also are like, yeah, but do you remember all the stuff you put mom and dad through? They are like that too. So that it's very.
Exactly.
Very similar. It's like, yeah, well, I mean, I had to rebel in ways you didn't have to rebel because those rules weren't in place for you. So it's a different thing, man.
There's echoes of Jacob's familial dysfunction, his family's dysfunction that just kind of ripples through time in all families. We've all got this going on.
Yeah, that's just what I was thinking, that it just shows how contemporary these stories are.
Yeah, well, Jacob himself was somebody who was like not liked by his dad as much as his brother, and liked more by his mother than his brother was. So he doesn't have like a real good example set forth for how to raise kids. It's like, well, pick a favorite.
Yeah.
And then hook him up.
And Abraham wasn't much different, you know. Abraham had his favorite Isaac,
mm-hmm.
who was the son of his old age. So yeah, I mean, in almost all these stories we've looked at so far, the parents are playing favorites one way or another. It's maybe more pronounced in the case of Jacob, but it was the same with his father and his grandfather. Yeah, there's not a solid, self-sacrificial, loving, compassionate family example that these guys can look back on.
It's almost so, like all these guys are sinners.
It's almost like that. Yeah, huh. It's almost like that. You know, I've often referred to the stories about these families as Norman Rockwell's nightmare. I really think that's an appropriate description of this, because, you know, this is anything but kind of the idealized Eden-like family atmosphere that a lot of people sometimes envision is in the Bible itself. It usually means they don't know anything about the Bible, because it's quite the opposite. I mean, if you want to see sin and all of its grotesqueness, usually all you have to do is look inside a family. That's where it comes out most of the time. Because I think the reason that is because when people are outside of their families, you know, at work or church or wherever they are outside a family situation, sometimes they force themselves to act appropriately or to speak appropriately. But then when they get home, they drop that guard and they're who they really are. And so you see a lot of times the ugly side of people, as well as the non-ugly side of people, but you see the ugly side of people displayed a lot of times in families, because they're not outside pretending they're somebody else. They're who they really are, which is sinners. And so we see some of the worst examples of what sin does to us inside families, not outside families. And so families end up being the exact opposite of what God designed them to be.
You know, Joseph was like running up to his brothers like, guys, check out this coat.
Oh yeah,
check out this. And you know, and his brothers are like, bro, I'm gonna choke you out with that coat.
I'm gonna rip it up and make it into a noose. We'll see how you like it then. Well, it gets worse, because okay, he's got the coat on. His brothers already know that dad likes him more than them. He's already brought back bad report about them. Well, we're going to go from the frying pan into the fire now, because it says that Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more.
Yeah, this is definitely, this is not like a Martin Luther King dream. I had a dream where we were all equal. No, it's like the opposite of that dream.
Yeah, this is the exact opposite of this dream. You gotta wonder, what is Joseph thinking? You know, he has a dream, and so he tells it to the very people that he's already given a bad report about, the very people that he knows his father doesn't love as much. How does he think they're going to react? So anyway, he says, okay, this is, he said to them, listen to this dream that I had. And the dream is basically a farming dream. They're binding sheaves in the field, and his sheaf rises up and stands erect, and all of the other sheaves, your sheaves, he says, his brother's sheaves, gathered around and bowed down to my sheaf. Then his brother said to him, "Oh, that's great news. We can't wait to bow down to you, Joseph." No, they it is interesting. Joseph doesn't even interpret the dream. The brothers know immediately what the dream means. So here's what they say. "Are you actually going to reign over us? Are you really going to rule over us?" And then the third time, hate is mentioned. So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words.
Now this is it's a little tricky, because like on one hand, like this is a prophetic dream, and the answer to their question is yeah he is. Yes, he is. Yes. Which is, you know, really unfortunate for them, and fortunate when it actually comes to pass. They're going to need that, but still, that's kind of a dream that you keep to yourself, because you're basically being like, check it out, hey guys. He runs up wearing his flamboyant coat and says, "Hey guys, just so you know, your work's going to bow down to my work." That's not, no, man.
A little twinkle in his eye.
Not that shrewd.
No. I do think Joseph grew in wisdom over the years, because this was a very unwise action at this point. And I was thinking about this morning too, that, you know, it's these dreams are prophetic, to be sure, but the understanding that the brothers have of the dream, and the understanding I'm sure that Joseph has of the dream, are very incomplete. Because when these dreams come to fulfillment, it's not merely that Joseph's brothers are bowing down to him, but you have to understand the whole context in which they're bowing down to him. They're bowing down to him as the one who has saved all of Egypt, as well as the surrounding lands, by this plan to set aside grain during the 7 years of famine. So it's not as if they're bowing down to him as mere subjects to an overlord. The context is much, much different than what they envision. All they're thinking of is, you know, he's going to be a king over us, and we're nothing more than his subjects. But as it turns out, he actually ends up being the one who saves them, and the one who forgives them, and the one who ends up bringing them and their father and the whole clan down into Egypt, so that they might have land and crops and so on and so forth. So at this point, anyway, in the story, I'm getting ahead of myself, but at this point of the story, they have a completely incomplete understanding of what these dreams actually mean. And Joseph himself does. All Joseph knows is what he dreamed. And so probably in his young 17-year-old mind, he's thinking the same thing the brothers are. Hey, that's going to be cool, because, I mean, I already had this coat, and I'm going to have a crown later, and all these brothers of mine are going to bow down to me, and I'll be their ruler.
Better go tell them about it.
Yeah, I better go tell them about it, because I'm sure that they need to know this.
They'll be really happy for me.
Yeah. And then we have another dream. Just keep moving here. He had another dream, and it's similar to the first one, except this time, and he tells it to his brothers. It says, this time, the sun and the moon and 11 stars were bowing down to him. And so he tells it to his brothers and to his father. And his father rebukes him. His father's not too happy about the dream, or about Joseph telling them the dream. He says, "What's this dream you've had? Shall I and your mother and your brothers actually come to bow ourselves before you to the ground?" And we have this interesting verse added after that. It says, "And his brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the saying in mind." So it was in the back of his mind, you know. His dad rebukes him, but I suspect, because of Jacob's own experience, there's this little voice in the back of his head that is saying, "I wonder if there might be something to this." Who knows? Well, we have different reactions from the father and from the brothers. I'm kind of surprised that Jacob himself wasn't happy about it, because after all, Joseph is his father's favorite.
Well, maybe that's why he like kind of kept it a little bit. Like, he has to rebuke him a little bit, because maybe even Jacob, even though he makes the dumb move of giving him the coat, knows that, hey, sharing this dream is not that prudent.
Yeah, maybe so. Yeah, he's trying to mollify his other sons, right? He's got to realize that they're angry, that maybe he realizes that they hate Joseph. And so he's got to do something to kind of put the brakes on this before it gets too far.
Now, there is also this kind of ragging on Jacob and Joseph here too. But then there is the reverse, which does show our inability to be it shows how jealous of creature we are too.
Yeah.
Because you do have his brothers who they do hate him, which is obviously a problem. And you know, sometimes Jacob has to be like somewhat to blame for the way Joseph is. Because if he's been favored since birth, well, a spoiled brat is a spoiled brat because he's been spoiled.
Mm-hmm. That's right? What his parents have done. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So Jacob is definitely played, he's made this bed, right? Mm-hmm. And right. And so his brothers, though, they're not able to sort of divide that up and realize, like, okay, so our brother is like, he's kind of a punk, but he's also a product of our dad sort of favoring him forever. Right. But instead, they do what we always do, and it's they get jealous and hateful, and that's what sinners do. And so it's like, man, he has that coat, I don't. So you got envy and covetousness going on there, and like, I'm not bowing down to you, you little twerp. It's all of that kind of stuff. So there's the whole thing is just like this mangled mess where Jacob favors Joseph, and this turns him into sort of this guy that can't that doesn't understand why everyone doesn't just love him that much. I mean, I must be so great. I mean, that's the impression I get of Joseph, is that he's like, I'm just really lovable. Yeah. You know, and maybe he's even confused, like, why don't my brothers recognize my awesomeness?
Yeah.
You know, and his brothers are like, why don't you recognize that there's, you know, that there's a bunch, there's 12 of us, and that you're a real pain in the neck.
Yeah, it's a royal mess.
Yeah,
I mean, there's nobody comes out of this clean. It's a good illustration too. Of the fact that jealousy is almost always self-interested. I mean, there is a jealousy which is interested in the other. You know, if I'm jealous for my wife, that means I want to stand up for her. I want her to not be harmed in any way or led astray or whatever it is. And so I protect her. I watch out for her. There is a true godly jealousy in that respect. But most of the jealousy that we experience is completely self-interested. It revolves around nothing more than simply I don't want to be hurt. I want what's best. I want what's best for me. I will not be ashamed. I will not be taken advantage of. So on and so forth. And so that kind of jealousy is usually interested in nothing more than the protection of self, which is exactly what we have going on in the case of the brothers here. They're jealous of Joseph because they're interested in what he has. I mean, there's none of them who would not want what Joseph had. I mean, they'd be great if their father loved them more. It'd be great if he'd have given them the coat of many colors. It'd be great if they're the ones that had these dreams. And because that doesn't happen to them, but it does happen to their brother, they're jealous of him.
Yeah, no, I don't think his brothers are being like, listen, we're angry because we're all about equality here.
Yeah, we just all want to be equally loved by dad. That's what we really want. No, they all want what Joseph has. Talk about a messed up family. That's what we got here. How much time do we have left here?
About.
Oh, we got about
five minutes.
All right. Okay. I think we cover another little section here before we run out of time, which it's kind of interesting. So, I don't know how much, Jacob realized what was going on actually, because of what he does next. If he was fully cognizant of the hatred that his sons felt for Joseph, I don't think that he would have done what he did next, because the brothers take the flocks down to Shechem, which we've heard about before. That's where Simeon and Levi wiped out the male population after they had him circumcised. So we're familiar with Shechem. So the brothers take the flock down to the area of Shechem to shepherd them. And Jacob says to Joseph, he says, look, your brothers are taking care of the flocks in Shechem, and I'm going to send you down there. I'm going to send you to them. And he said, I'll go. He says, go see about the welfare of your brothers and the welfare of the flock and bring word back to me. Of course, he could trust on Joseph to do that because he showed his willingness to do that earlier. So anyway, he goes. He sends him from the Valley of Hebron, and he goes to Shechem. And this is a small detail in the story, but I've always found it interesting. I'm in verse 15. It says, he gets down there, and it says a man found him. Just a man. A man found him. And he was wandering in the field, Joseph was. And the man asked him, what are you looking for? And Joseph said, I'm looking for my brothers. Please tell me where they are pasturing the flock. And the man said, they've moved from here, for I heard them say, let us go to Dothan. And so Joseph went after his brothers and found them at Dothan. Now, Dan, you mentioned earlier that, you know, there's, when the scriptures give details, it's always significant because they're sparse on details most of the time. And so we have these few verses here. We have, and this anonymous stranger who just shows up while Joseph is wandering in a field and who just happens to have overheard where Joseph's brothers have moved their flock to. So Joseph is just, you know, kind of wandering around aimlessly in his field, and a stranger comes up to him and says, oh yeah, those guys, yeah, I was close enough to overhear where they were going. And the reason I found this interesting is because I think this is a great example of one example in this story of how God is kind of behind the scenes, who is guiding these events, even though to the human participants, and even to some extent to us who are reading the story, it's hidden from us, because he sends this anonymous guy to find Joseph wandering in a field, to send him the way, the place that that he needs to go. It's really exemplary of so many details that we're going to see as we go through the life of Joseph, where things which are seemingly inconsequential or things which are blatantly negative all in some way fall into the divine plan that God has to bring Joseph and then later all of Israel down into Egypt. And it's just a great thing to keep in mind too, that, you know, in the confusion of our daily lives with all the stuff that happens to us, some of it just quite mundane, some of it significant, that, it's often hidden from our eyes just how God is at work to use people and events to finally bring about what he desires for us. It's a great example of how God is hidden in these seemingly meaningless details of daily life in some way to point us in the direction that he wants us to go.
Yeah, yeah. I'm like, I read that and I'm like, angel, maybe?
Yeah.
Maybe not,
yeah,
just, maybe saying, so. Just saying.
Maybe. Maybe so. I mean, we have plenty of other cases where, you know, a man appears and it's actually an angel.
Yeah. No, this sounds, this is a messenger. Yeah, this is a divine setup.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Clearly. Yeah.
Dude is being set up.
He's leading him to the brothers and then into the pit and then finally into Egypt. So God's working this out, even though Joseph has absolutely no idea that it's happening to him.
Yeah. And dude, that's it.
We're out of time. 40 out of time. Minutes.
The we didn't get far. We see the divine stage being set. Joseph's being set up by God. God's yeah. giving him dreams and sending him messengers to get him down to a bunch of hacked off brothers to Then next week we will see exactly how they respond, and I, as you can imagine, it's with much grace and forbearance. So hey, Christ Hold Fast is listener supported stuff. If you enjoy this podcast or any other stuff we do, you can go over to ChristHoldFast.org and go to the support page or the giving page. You can make a donation, one-time donation or a reoccurring donation, and that would help us out. Thank you so much to those of you who have done that. Christ Hold Fast city events. We got one in New York coming up June 11th. That's coming up soon. And we got one in Dallas on October 29th. For more information on those events, they're cheap. They're one day, they're all day, and they're jam-packed. And you'd want to be there if you're anywhere around those two areas. You can go over to ChristHoldFast.org and get more information about that. All right, we're out of time, so we will see you guys next week.